Monday, August 5th, LA Podcast. Hayes Davenport, Scott Frazier. That's it.
Nope. No Alyssa.
No Alyssa. We do have a guest later on in the show, Albert Corrado, brother of Melly Corrado, who was killed at Trader Joe's almost exactly 1 year ago by LAPD as they were pursuing another suspect. He's here to talk about the ongoing effort to keep his sister's memory alive and how they are suing LAPD and the city for her death. Right now, let's talk. Do you have a story?
I mean, my LA story is we're recording this on Sunday. There were multiple different mass shooting events yesterday.
Yep.
So I kind of spent a lot of time thinking about like what it is as a person who lives in LA that like what is the best way as somebody who lives in California to support like Senate races elsewhere,
right,
presidential candidates elsewhere, like in such a way that maybe one day, like in public places in this country, we won't have to be afraid that we're about to get shot by a Nazi.
Yeah,
is I think the current thing. Mm-hmm. So I would love, I guess this is more of a call for help for me. Help me figure out what it is that I can do to help Democratic candidates for Senate win. I've been thinking, you know, sometimes I do travel to other parts of the country and maybe I could just stay in those places a bit longer and volunteer on campaigns there. But I want to do it hopefully in a way that I can afford.
Yeah.
And hopefully in a way where I'm not destroying the environment by flying every weekend, right, to a different state. So
I struggle with this a little bit too, partially because one of the reasons we do this show is to focus, to pull attention from, yeah, those stuff happening in other states or, sure, in the federal government or all these things. And I think there is something that we can take home from these shootings. Everyone's right to be talking about gun regulation, but this was also about a persecuted group,
yeah,
of Latin Americans and primarily undocumented people that we have more, yep, of in this county than anywhere else, yeah, in the United States. So in a time where these people are deservedly very afraid of both the government and a lot of the citizens, what can we do as people who live here, who are much safer, to make them more comfortable? And I think a big question is like, what can elected officials do in the, yeah, face of a federal government that they are in some cases kind of powerless against? Like, how do you make people feel safe and secure? I don't know what the answer is.
I mean, you really do want to see the answer to the radical hatred of the Republican Party at large, the president, and now growing numbers of disaffected white nationalists with access to high-powered firearms. Like, you want to see the response to that kind of hatred to be a real positive message of empowerment and like radical inclusion and love. And that is not what we see in Los Angeles. Like you're saying, we have more people who are living undocumented here than pretty much anywhere else, and yet we still hold these communities at arm's length. We're not, even though we live in a city that is governed entirely by Democrats, there is not a real push to do anything outside of normal operating,
right,
procedure to make those communities feel like they are safe and welcome here, which is,
right,
disheartening.
Seems like something they could be saying is, you look at a city like El Paso, which has a pretty large population of undocumented people, is, or was until yesterday, the safest city in the United States, essentially. People in LA could be saying, we want to create a community as like generous to this population and as kind as,
right,
as El Paso is.
Yeah.
The shooter wasn't from there. He drove 700 miles,
yep,
to Target,
yep,
this place. So I think there's an opportunity to kind of lift El Paso up as a model,
right,
in a place like LA. I mean, this is not really to say that elected officials are doing anything like really wrong in their reaction to this, but I think,
right,
there are opportunities to focus on our undocumented population, how to empower them, how to make them feel more secure that aren't necessarily being taken.
Sure. I think also we know, you know, a ton of people who are in America who are of Hispanic or Mexican descent are born and raised in America, are American citizens, etc. And I think, you know, like when we talk about what does it take, what would it look like for Los Angeles as a city and as a region to actively try to incorporate the people who are living here, who are Hispanic, who are of Mexican descent, actually into our democratic body and alleviate some of the historical racism that has been exacted against them. It's we have major issues with environmental racism in LA where mm-hmm. like if you look outside today, like the air quality is terrible, but yeah. like it's much worse in the East where like the percentage of the population that is Latinx is much higher than on the West side. There are freeways cutting through Boyle Heights, you know, like that we have our high injury network where people are disproportionately much more likely to be hit and killed by cars on city streets. Those are almost entirely in low income Black and brown neighborhoods. And we don't do anything about yeah. those things. You know, like we've really struggled as a city to ameliorate that in any way. So yeah. those are things that we could do to improve lives for people in, yeah. in a real way here.
Pretty basic way, and this never even occurred to me for just to kind of let people into the political process here. There is a huge population of people who speak English as a second language or not at all. If they go to any public meeting, they're going to be completely lost. Mm-hmm. I would say at the very least, council and supervisor meetings could have the option that you get if you go to the UN or something, right. a live translator who can yeah. at least be providing context for things going on. Yeah. Just get a set of headphones and you can hear what's happening. I mean, you can get a tour in Spanish at LACMA. It doesn't seem like that infrastructure would be that hard
no, definitely.
To set up. Speaking of elected officials in LA doing things wrong this week, it feels like there were a lot of a range from missteps to actively antagonistic moves by people mostly in City Hall against the community of people who are homeless. We talk about it a lot on the show, but this week it felt like there was like a density of stories around these issues. Probably the most important one, City Council had an opportunity again to weigh in on a rule that's numbered 85.02 that outlaws sleeping in your car in most parts of the city, except for a small number of major arteries. Every 6 months, they look at this policy, they study it, and every 6 months since it was instituted a few years ago, they have unanimously ruled to maintain this policy. We've talked about it a few times on the show, how criminalizing sleeping in your car gives people like these big fines. Often, if they aren't able to pay the fines, it can end up in a cycle where the fines grow and grow. They can end up in jail. And it just makes it much harder for people to live stable lives and get into housing. This week, it was a 13-0 vote in the council to maintain 85.02, despite every speaker who showed up for yeah. the council meeting voicing opposition to this rule.
We are seeing, I think, a major turning point in the activism within the city, the activism for both places for individuals who are homeless to live, for places for them to get service. We're seeing, I think, a groundswell of activist support for the city not doing things like this. I think that has already borne some fruit in the sense that Mayor Garcetti announced earlier this year that the city had been pressured to move more in the direction advocated for by the Services Not Sweep Coalition, spearheaded by LA CAN, Community Action Network. That was a major victory, even if it was just a first step in that direction this year. But this is, like you were saying, this is something that has routinely come up for review in the past, been passed again, extended again unanimously. And here we're seeing hundreds of people show up with the express purpose of telling City Hall, do not do this. Mm-hmm. This is bad policy. It is punitive. It's shameful. Overwhelmingly, the comments were telling City Hall not to proceed with this extension. However, as they are wont to do, they did extend the ordinance again by a 13-0 vote with
yeah.
Mike Bonin and
Bob Blumenfield
absent. Not in attendance.
Bob Blumenfield did post somewhere afterwards that he would have voted yes as well. Mike Bonin had a medical, I think he had a slipped disc or something, said that he would have voted no. So that is the first time I can think of any council member being on record saying that they would not continue this policy, which they should not only for humanitarian reasons, it's in opposition to their goal of reducing homelessness. If people cannot, if their cars get towed away, they end up out on the street. It is so much harder to get out of homelessness without a car.
Yeah.
Like this makes the problem worse.
It absolutely makes the problem worse. And we also, of course, after being voted upon by the council, the mayor signed it as well. So we have basically everybody on record, aside from Mike Bonin, saying that that they are in favor of this policy. You do kind of wonder why, given the fact that we have so much evidence that this will lead people literally onto the streets, people who have a small respite from that life right now by virtue of being able to seek shelter in their cars. You do wonder why, given the fact that we are seeing an explosion in the number of people who are experiencing homelessness in this city, why would we take this tack, continue to force people to live on the streets when there's not a good reason to do so? Yeah. You do think that, at least I think that the response from the city seems to be almost solely in response to the loudest voices among home-owning residents of the city, people who are probably high proclivity voters, but who also have channels to their representatives in City Hall that other people just simply don't have. Like, it's doesn't seem right or reasonable that you would have this kind of outcry and response, and just have it be totally ignored.
So my friend Adam Conover, who a lot of people, I've heard people say he ruins everything. I've actually found him to improve many things. He went to, there was like a meet your representatives representative event the other night, I believe at the Edendale or maybe at the Los Feliz Library. And representatives for Adam Schiff and the mayor and David Rue and Mitch O'Farrell and people in kind of the northeast LA-ish area were in attendance, and he talked to some of them from the council about 8502, and they basically said, A, we rarely enforce this, which to me is almost more shameful. I mean, like, you're just making people afraid on purpose to indulge the paranoia of homeowners,
right?
Just to throw a bone to homeowners, justify their fear even more, and say that you don't enforce it very often, then there's absolutely no reason to have this rule. Then they do. And I mean, it's not in huge, huge numbers, but they do enforce it. And they also basically said, we have to find a balance between the desires of homeowners and the desires of people who are homeless. But that, to me, does not account for the impacts of this policy. The desires of, like, the impact on homeowners of having people who are homeless present in their neighborhoods is one thing. It's a quality of life issue, but this can be a life ruining impact for people who are homeless.
I think that this is a way in which LA city government and various governments in LA County operate frequently. It's something that is explicitly, in my view, bad governance. This is among the worst practices that you could possibly have for a local agency possessed of local police powers to say, we're going to put this rule on the books with the intention that we are not going to routinely enforce it. Whereas they were telling this to Adam from a place that would allow them some wiggle room to say, hey, we're not completely heartless. We'll make exceptions for people as the case may be. The reality is what they're actually saying, and I've spoken and written at length about this, particularly as it relates to Metro and Metro's code of conduct, in which a number of things are expressly forbidden that are basically never enforced. It opens the door for punitive interactions with law enforcement. It opens the door for violent interactions with law enforcement. And otherwise, basically, far from being the case that they are actually putting themselves in a good light by allowing themselves the ability to make exceptions as they so desire, what they're actually doing is giving themselves the ability to criminalize at will without really being attached to the law that they're using or the ordinance that they're using to criminalize individuals. This is something that can be used to either create a situation in which a person can forcefully be removed from a location or can be used to enhance the punishment that will be rendered to that person. As you said, this can be a life-ruining event for somebody who happens to be dwelling in their vehicle. The notion that we are going to pass an ordinance with the intention to mostly not enforce it means that it is not something that should be on the books, mm-hmm. period. It just should not. If it is not something that is in any way harming people in like 90%+ of cases, then leaving yourself the ability to punish somebody for doing this is cowardly and we shouldn't do it.
A lot of talk from council members about how they're putting up safe parking lots and giving people places to put their cars. I believe the ultimate plan for the number of spots is 300 in a county with 16,500 or so people who sleep in their cars. I also know for a fact that there are at least one lot in Mitchell Farrell's district in CD13 that is ready to go. Both the site and the providers are ready to get this lot up and running, and they're just waiting for City Hall to send the final contracts. The council is afraid of entrenched interests in the form of homeowners who push back on this stuff. But I like that increasingly they're probably starting to feel afraid of people who are pushing back on these rules as well, because the many community groups and activist groups who went to the city council meeting the other day when they were ruling on 8502 got the meeting shut down because they literally yelled so loud about this policy and how destructive it was. Speaking of the City Hall imposing policies that ruin people's lives, Eric Garcetti went to do a photo op earlier this week in North Hollywood, and he was going to an encampment. His office called reporters, including Matt Tinoco, friend of the show, from KPCC, to say, hey, come look like at the conditions here and watch the mayor talk to these people. And so Matt Tinoco goes and like he talks to Garcetti. And then Garcetti leaves and Matt sets up a time to come back and talk to some of the people who live in the encampment. He goes, he comes back and he watches a Bureau of Sanitation truck take two shopping carts filled with possessions of people who live in this encampment and crush them and destroy everything inside while the people had left the camp for a second. Mm-hmm. He talked to the woman, Chriselle, whose possessions had been destroyed. She said that she lost her ID, her medicine, her cell phone, some food, clothes, and pictures of her children, as well as the contact info of an outreach worker that she had just received from the mayor's team. It turned out after some digging from Matt that it was the mayor's office who had
directed sanitation to
who had called this in. And there was some discrepancy over whether they had been intending to target, there were some empty shopping carts that they wanted to take away or something like that. But just calling it in demonstrates a total lack of understanding of how this works. If some official is not there to direct the process of cleaning up an encampment, people will lose important things to them.
What is the organization? So, and this is kind of the thing where we talked about this recently from the other end of things. We talked about the transition from, and I refuse to even learn the distinction here, the transition from either care to hope or hope to care, that from the perspective of a person living in the river, from the perspective of a person living on the streets or in their car or whatever the case might be in a tent, that you're seeing the same individuals coming, that you're seeing city sanitation workers, you're seeing LAPD. And why would you believe that things are going to be different when organizationally you're interacting with the same people? So,
or not, if you're not there, your stuff is just getting thrown out without you being there.
Sure. But
probably
now
it feels the same.
But now I want to talk about it from the other side, right? Like from the city sanitation side, this is the same organization. You have been receiving for years and years this direction from politicians and from your bosses that we need to clean up streets by seizing people's belongings, crushing them and like moving on. And so now it is politically expedient for the mayor's office to say everything is different. Look how different everything is. But what does it actually take to change the organizational culture and to actually filter that message down to the people whose job it is to go out and do whatever goal is set for them by the mayor's office and by the people who are the head bureaucrats at the Sanitation Bureau. And the fact that this is happening seems to suggest that there is an, I would say, incomplete focus on the actual operationalization of the changed philosophy that Mayor Garcetti is saying that he's brought to bear to deal with the homelessness situation. And the fact that that is the case, it doesn't reflect well on any of the political actors involved, because it's one thing to try and get good headlines and say, like, we are doing things in a kinder way now, but you can't just say that and make it so. It requires concerted effort. It requires actual changes to be made. I don't want to be glib about this, because it is, you know, it's horrible to hear. And I would like to give the mayor the benefit of the doubt that he would like to have seen something positive come of his interaction with this woman whose possessions are, you know, as KPCC puts it, as Matt Tinoco puts it, she's further from getting the help that she needs now. And that's terrible. You really just want to, like, this is awful, and it did not need to happen this way, right? Like, this fundamentally should not have happened.
But it demonstrates to me a total lack. I mean, it's just like, there's so much clarity from this to me that people, I think the mayor himself and people in his office, have no fucking idea what is
What's happening
on, and like the impacts of like certain things that they can do.
Right.
Just like calling Bureau of Sanitation to say, like, hey, go out there and throw out some shopping carts is like basically the equivalent of calling the police and saying, like, hey, there's a black guy with a knife like in this area.
Yeah.
You are causing like the potential for incredible harm and chaos by doing something like that.
And doing it in a way that suggests that you haven't really even given contextual thought to what might happen. But and that's exactly what I mean, is like, from the perspective of somebody who nominally has the authority to oversee what these departments on a daily basis, if this is something that the mayor's office is serious about changing, you know, that is the kind of detail-oriented stuff that they need to be involved in actually changing.
Yep.
What does it mean to call sanitation and have them go out to these places? And what happens if something goes wrong?
Yeah. You know? Another thing that I think is even more illuminating, possibly even more fucked up than the act itself, is this quote that Matt got from Garcetti. Matt basically said, hey, what are you doing out here? Why are you here? Seems like a pretty easy question to answer for the mayor. Could say just trying to give people connections to resources on all these things, like to like give them the leg up. He said, one of the things I'm doing constantly is getting out there on the streets, A, to see the conditions in neighborhoods that I hear about from constituents and stakeholders. There's a little,
right?
You know, like, stakeholders never means homeless people.
No, it doesn't.
That never, ever is what that means. And B, to talk to folks and see if I can help inspire them to get off the streets. One of the things that's kind of magical is, as mayor, sometimes I can make the difference of whether someone says, today's the day that I'll actually come off the streets. What's he saying with that?
Yeah.
He's saying that people have the choice, basically any time, if they're sufficiently inspired to say, okay, I'm tired of this. Like, I'm ready to get off the streets and get into housing. What that says to me, what's so illuminating about that is all of the other policies, all the criminalization policies are with this kind of thinking in mind.
Yep.
They say, if we can make it unpleasant enough for them on the streets, they will make the choice that they could make whenever they want to get into housing. So it's either inspiration from the mayor or being sufficiently pushed to the edge by police and sanitation and city hall. They'll eventually like pick themselves up and get off the streets. That is so far from reality.
Yeah.
This same week, Carla Hall at the LA Times wrote a piece about meeting a woman who was homeless, someone who wanted to get into a shelter, just get into a shelter, someplace to spend the night.
Yeah.
It is impossible to get into a shelter if you want to, just like that day. If you're feeling sick, if you are exposed to the sun, if you want to just get into a shelter, we've tried to get people in with CELA. You cannot do it. You need to connect them with a caseworker, and they have to be like signed up with somebody and then get submitted to go into a shelter. It can take days, and if you're trying to do it on a weekend, it is impossible.
It is the suggestion that we are seeing just absolutely ballooning numbers of people experiencing homelessness, that could possibly be as a result of people just suddenly losing the will to have shelter mm-hmm. at night makes no sense. It doesn't stand up to any kind of scrutiny. Like the issue is that people have no place to go. The city has failed to provide places for people to live. As a region, as a state, we're failing on a yearly basis to do the bare necessity to actually give people a choice to have a home. And mm-hmm. so, like, you know, like the thought that it's just like a lack of inspiration. I mean, it's the mayor is very enthusiastic in his love of the movie La La Land. And you kind of like it. He's not just going to like tap dance his way into people's hearts and then they're like going to...
They start dancing too, like their feet right. start moving and they don't understand what's happening and they tap and dance into a one-bedroom
montage their way into a house. Yeah, no, it's not going
to
happen.
Like you're saying, they have no places to go and they can't even get access to the place before the place. It is impossible to get into drug treatment right. on your own. It's impossible to get into mental health care.
Right.
And even shelter, even bridge housing, the shelter before the real shelter... is so hard to get into.
Yep.
There are no number of inspiring conversations with the mayor that can get someone off the street. You need actual services, and to discontinue practices like throwing all people's possessions away that step people back in terms of this process. Okay. We're not even going to talk about the house and the mansion in Tarzana where the streamer house.
Wait, what?
There were some internet trolls who said that a house where a Twitch streamer lives was a homeless shelter, and lots of people who are homeless because the need is so great here went out to Tarzana because they thought there was a shelter there because of a prank. We didn't even have time to talk about that. Let's get into AB5. So this is the law that is in the process of passing through the California legislature that would declare gig...
Hopefully it will be a law.
Yes. A bill. Sorry, right now it's a bill.
It's just a bill.
That would declare gig workers, like those who work for Uber, basically full-time employees. What is the news on AB5 this week, Scott?
So what we have this week is, and this has kind of been a continuous drumbeat over the course of the past month or two, the legislation pending right now in Sacramento has passed the assembly, and we are coming up towards the end of the first year of the legislative session. So basically by mid-September, if AB5 is going to pass this year, it needs to make it all the way through the Senate where it currently is. There has been an extraordinary push by tech companies of all varieties, not just tech companies. As you were mentioning to me, there are also other industries such as the media where you're talking about paying freelance writers.
Yeah, writers are at least like trying to figure out how this bill would affect them if it became law, because lots of writers and so many people in Hollywood work on kind of a gig to gig basis. So what does that mean if you're a full-time employee every time you take a writing or acting job or whatever?
Right. So the legislation, AB5, was put forth by Lorena Gonzalez out of San Diego. Just to run through really quickly what it would do, basically what we're talking about is the codification of a judicial ruling that came down from the state Supreme Court about a year and a half ago, I believe, which is referred to as the Dynamex ruling. This would, if passed, give some legislative teeth to a standard of determining whether or not somebody is an independent contractor or if they have to be considered an employee of the company for which they are working. The ruling used what is known now as the ABC test, which is basically saying that an individual can be determined to be an independent contractor if they work independently, if the work that they're doing is outside of the firm's usual operations, and if the individual is customarily engaged in an independently established trade, occupation, or business of the same nature as what they do for the company. If they don't meet those three standards, then what we're saying is they are actually an employee of the company, which is different than the way that companies such as Uber and Lyft, most prominently, both of which have gone public earlier this year, they have been treating what under the Dynamex ruling would be considered their employees as not being full-time employees. They're contractors. They're people who are doing gigs. This is what they're commonly referred to as. So by virtue of that, Uber doesn't have to pay them a minimum wage. Uber doesn't have to, or Uber and Lyft don't have to pay them minimum wage. None of these companies have to provide for benefits as required under California law for employees. They don't have collective bargaining rights in the same way that they would if they were considered employees. Earlier this year, we, of course, saw a series of strikes by drivers, by, let's say, like workers at Amazon's delivery contractors that were all aimed at getting better pay, better conditions. And I think that the growth in the gig economy has generally just created an atmosphere of concern that we are ending up with a large segment of the economy where the power of corporations is not checked at all. Mm-hmm. Uber and Lyft and other tech companies have responded by saying that they want to create a third category in between independent contractors and actual traditional employees that would allow for some amount of bargaining rights, but would not require the companies, the employers to give them everything that would be accorded to them under the law if they were employees. So that fight is still playing out. I think it's important to take in the context of this that we are also getting numbers from Uber and Lyft now that they are public companies, and those numbers are extremely grim. The Guardian had a report just today, I believe, that was about the rate at which Uber has lost money since declaring that it was going to go public. And I think in this current quarter, this current financial quarter, they have lost upwards of $4 billion. And
you would think that were AB5 to pass, and especially were it to become law in other places, that would they would lose more under their current model.
Under their current model, yes. And so basically when Uber got its start, when Lyft got its start, and of course there were a couple of other major competitors back in 2014 or so, most of which have folded since then, these ride-hailing companies, they explicitly pursued a strategy that was subsidize the cost of rides in order to increase revenue. Mm. The venture capital that is and was funding them was expecting to not be able to turn a profit until such a point in time as most of their competition had been cut out of the market.
Yep.
Now, the rides are still subsidized at this point in time, but the companies, it's well known, cannot ever be profitable as long as that remains the case. So we may see rides having to be significantly more expensive. We're talking maybe twice as much as they currently cost,
which would put them in many cases more expensive than the taxis that they have pushed out of the market.
Exactly.
But with less regulation.
And that is assuming that there is no change such as AB5. If they were to need to also pay for overhead costs at the rate that they would be required to under the AB5 legislation, we might see those costs be even higher.
Yeah.
So, That remains to be seen, but it is something that we will have news on within the next month or so.
I think it's also worth mentioning that Uber paid its drivers, I think, $100 each to show up to protests.
Yes.
And pretend to want to be a third kind of employee. Yep. Rather than to receive health benefits. Train news. We talked about the high-speed rail. The initial plan was scrapped. Gavin Newsom was pushing a plan to build a partial system from Bakersfield to Merced. Now there's a little momentum behind a new plan and actually put heavy rail money into urban areas instead of the Central Valley, specifically the Bay Area and Los Angeles. What's the plan for LA specifically? What's being talked about?
So right now what is being talked about specifically is in relation to a plan that has been kicked around for a number of years, just had a report come out in a Metro meeting pretty recently to enhance service on the 5 corridor where Metrolink runs from Burbank to Anaheim,
yeah.
I believe. Right now, Metro is looking at the northern half of that between Burbank and Union Station, adding infill stations for Metrolink to use, enhancing service so that trains would run once every 30 minutes instead of currently the schedule is much more restrictive than that.
Where would the infill stations go, you think, between Burbank and Union Station?
They actually have a couple of locations already picked out. One would be around the Taylor Yards area that was being talked about as a location for Olympic Housing at one point. Now it is part of the river redevelopment. I think two or so would be in the Glendale area, yep. So near Broadway there, and then probably an extra infill station mm-hmm. in Burbank.
Notably, Laura Friedman, yes. guest on this show, who represents Glendale, is for this project.
Yeah, and this is actually getting a lot of support from the Assembly. Anthony Rendon, speaker, is also in favor, which is a bad sign for the prospects of the High Speed Rail project as it stands today.
Yeah.
Gavin Newsom potentially doing what many Republicans have tried and failed to do, killing high speed rail with his words. But yeah, no, I think that we are at a place where reconsideration of this project now seems inevitable.
It's a big reconsideration. We should point out this is not a high speed rail project. It's not like these are diesel trains. This is not like the zippy, like silent electric train that people were sort of hoping for.
This is that's exactly right. And this is kind of unfortunate too, because we are still we're still planning for a relatively outmoded form of commuter rail in our region that has now is many decades outmoded in other developed countries. We're not talking about the kind of electric multiple units that are available in other places. Germany notably has many such systems, Switzerland and Japan as well. These are systems that it is a significant step down in ambition from the high speed rail project that was originally proposed to voters. I will say that. Mm-hmm. But you do get the sense that it was a major political miscalculation for Gavin Newsom to say that we were going to focus on the Bakersfield to San Francisco segment to the exclusion of all of Southern California.
And not even Bakersfield to San Francisco, Bakersfield to Merced.
Merced, right. And so that is problematic. You know, we are, and you can see there's, I think, some division among transit advocates, some of whom view the high-speed rail project as having become an unworkable boondoggle that needs to be basically redrawn from the ground up. But with the concentration of legislators in Southern California, where such a high percentage of the state's population actually lives, you do have to wonder, as soon as the governor comes out and says, we can't deliver mm-hmm. on what we originally promised to voters, how much longer this project can go on before legislators completely turn on it. I don't think it has long.
This would derail, so to speak, the also getting an electric rail on that Bakersfield to Merced track. So they would continue building that track with some of this rail money, but it would not be electric mm-hmm. either.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this is all kind of falling apart, I think, faster than I thought it would have after Newsom took over.
Right. I mean, so in his State of the State, he said that it needed to be rethought, and we couldn't.
That is definitely happening.
It's definitely happening. And then his staff came out and said, you know, he didn't mean what you think he meant when he said that. But it does seem like legislators are taking that seriously and starting to look at how this money can be put to use in their own parts of the state instead.
Let's go to our guest, Albert Corrado, brother of Melly Corrado, who was killed at Trader Joe's 1 year ago. He is on the show now. A couple weeks ago, July 21st, was the 1 year anniversary of the shooting of Melly Corrado at Trader Joe's. She was a Trader Joe's employee. She was shot and killed by LAPD officers at Trader Joe's. They were pursuing another suspect, Gene Evan Atkins, who ended up pulling up inside the store. Our guest is her brother, Albert Corrado, who has really been carrying her memory and the torch like ever since then. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me. Yeah. I'll start by saying, and I kind of said this before, I enjoy the show. Like, as someone who hasn't always been into like local stuff and transit and politics, I find it actually pretty fascinating. So yeah, it's thank you guys for having me on. I was hoping that someday this would happen. So
well, you're in it now. You are involved.
Yes.
You were living in Minneapolis at the time of Melly's death. You now live here permanently.
Permanently. I brought my car and all my belongings, had it shipped back. I wasn't even willing to go and like drive my car back. I was just so focused on what was going on here. And also my dad, you know, the fragility of life was very much in his eyesight. So he didn't really want me going. So yeah, I've been here since July 22nd.
Uh-huh. So and you're here to stay.
Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, I don't know what the future holds. I never thought I would move to Minneapolis, or I've lived in San Francisco before, Vegas, so I don't know what, but I'd say for at least 5 to 10 years, I'll be here and dealing with the fallout from Melly's death and
yeah.
and all that stuff.
So you knew as soon as you got the word of the shooting, you knew that you were going to be in LA for the long term following that. Is that right?
I think, yeah. I mean, you know, it's hard to, you know, that day is, I remember something so vividly and then yeah. some of it is a blur and my timeline gets a little messed up. But I mean, as soon as I was trying to leave that night, but like the Minneapolis airport isn't like a... It's not LAX, you know, it was like 9 p.m. by the time I made it over there and I just couldn't find a flight. So I yeah. had to go back to my apartment and I'd be on Twitter and see my whole world like crumble before me. But
yeah,
and I was able to leave at, I think it was like 6 a.m. And that, you know, when I was in on the plane, I thought, well, I'll at least be here for 2 weeks and we'll figure this out. And as soon as I saw my dad, I was just like, this is it. Like,
yeah.
whatever. I didn't have a girlfriend or any big career thing going on in Minneapolis. I just thought this is where I have to be. It's yeah. where I'm needed. And I'm very happy that I made that decision because I've been able to do some good stuff.
Yeah. Let's talk about that good stuff. I went to the memorial a couple of weeks ago. I went to the funeral last year and I was struck by on both occasions how you set a very specific tone about how you were approaching Melly's death. So the city attorney's office has charged Gene Evan Atkins, the suspect who LAPD was pursuing with Melly's murder,
yes.
correct?
Yeah.
Second, like there's some kind of...
Yeah, I mean, the you know, I don't know. The logic is that he set off the chain of events and
right.
that's what they're... I don't know what it'll go down as, you know, manslaughter or something, but yeah,
right.
that's where it currently stands.
But she was shot by LAPD who pulled up to the store, fired into the grocery store, trying to hit Gene Evan Atkins and hitting Melly.
Yeah.
On both occasions at the memorial a couple weeks ago and at the funeral, you and your family from the beginning have very much wanted people to understand how Melly died. I was actually most struck by something you said at the memorial recently where you said Melly didn't die. She was killed.
Yeah.
Right.
Tell us why that is an important thing that you want people to acknowledge.
I think it's just that, you know, it's obviously what happened and it's a way to differentiate it in that, you know, I don't say Melly died like she had a disease or mm-hmm. died in a car accident. It, you know, the way that she died was in a very public way, a very public place, you know, by an organization that represents LA. And my father and I want people to remember that. Whatever your opinion on cops or whatever history you may have with them, whatever history I may have with them or, you know, growing up in LA and all that, it doesn't matter. It's the fact that Melly was 27.
Yeah.
Was, you know, had transferred to Silver Lake in November of 2017 and in July was dead. And she was extremely excited. I was going through her belongings and I saw the paperwork where she signed to become a what they call a mate, which is their like kind of a like more than a shift lead, but less than a full blown manager. Right. That's what they call him. But she was so excited. And, you know, we took her out to dinner to go and celebrate this because she had done it in like pretty record time for a job like that. Like these people, I know people that, because I worked for Trader Joe's for a time and I saw people who were in that company for 9 years and were just making mate. Melly was there for maybe four and made it. And she was very, very proud. And the fact that she got promoted and went to a store and was able to click and gain so many people that loved her. You know, I've talked to so many of them and it is a very genuine bond that she created with people. And I, you know, I knew her as my sister, so I knew that she had that effect on people. And I want people to, you know, realize that like she wasn't famous. She wasn't a person that anyone would ever probably have known, but now she is. And that's the, you know, the reason is because of what happened. And I want Melly to be remembered, but I want people to, again, without any agenda, without any preconceived notions, this is what happened. And we're never going to shy away from that because it's out of respect to my sister. Because I know if I had been shot and killed this way, Melly would be doing exactly what I'm doing. She'd be sitting here with you guys probably. You know what I mean? She would be doing, you know, putting on an event. She would be doing everything in her power to make sure that I wasn't forgotten. And for me, like I never for a moment doubt that I'm doing the right thing in terms of respecting Melly. And, you know, that's always going to be our thing. Melly was killed. She didn't die. She wasn't just there and she died of heat stroke or someone hit her with a car. It was, you know, you want to read about it. People ask me all the time what happened. Google it. I don't mm-hmm. want to go over it all, you know, over and over. But yeah, I mean, it's out of respect to Melly. I love her. I loved her and respected her so much. And she was my younger sister, but in a lot of ways, she was like an older sibling.
Yeah.
And, you know, I looked up to her sometimes. So like for me, there is no other way.
So when you talk about keeping her memory alive and making sure that people know what happened to your sister, aside from the memorials that we've been talking about, what are the other things that your family is actively trying to do to make sure that justice is done for your sister and make sure that people do keep her memory?
We're suing the city and the LAPD, and for us, that was the only option. That was the only way that nothing will bring Melly back. I've lived with that. I say it in my head and it messes with me and it's awful, but it's not going to happen. But it's just, you know, we want to send a message that this isn't right, and that I don't care who it was or what happened or what anybody wants to say about putting ourselves in any position. It shouldn't have happened. Melly was, her last conscious act as a human being was to go help someone. Right. Like the car, you know, she thought she heard a car accident. She went outside to help someone, not knowing what awaited her.
And of course, so to describe the chain of events, we have a vehicular pursuit, as happens so frequently in LA.
They love to, like, I'm on Twitter. Absolutely. It's like every day they're following someone. And like, now I'm just like hoping that it doesn't lead to something horrific.
So it does happen with extreme frequency. And so we had a vehicular chase that led from, I believe, South LA north to Silver Lake. The police vehicles followed the suspect, Gene Atkins, around the corner onto Hyperion. The suspect crashed his vehicle, then ran into the Trader Joe's. The video, which was made public shortly thereafter, showed police getting out from their dash cams, getting out of their vehicles and opening fire in the direction of the store almost immediately, as you said.
And saying, shoot through the windows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you said, your sister believed when she heard a crash that there was potentially something that she could do to help somebody, and not knowing that there had been this police chase and everything, and was struck by a bullet that one of the police had fired in their attempt to actively shoot into the store. So really a horrific chain of events.
Yeah. And I replay it in my head all the time. And I always like kind of like, oh, man, if he had crashed outside of Gelson's or right, somewhere that wasn't heavily populated, you know, we would be having a different conversation. Yeah. But that's what happened.
But let's talk about the aftermath as far as the LAPD is concerned. They have said, Chief Michael Moore has said that the officers followed protocol in that situation, both in the chase and in the firing into the store. That was standard operating procedure, and nothing has changed in terms of how they approach these situations. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it is, and I'm watching Twitter, I'm on there, I'm seeing the way that people are being pursued, and there's never a minute where I'm like, oh, this is going to end okay.
Right.
I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop and something truly awful to happen. Yeah. And yeah, it's been over a year since Melly died, and from what I can tell, it's business as usual.
How did you learn that that the LAPD had found that this was all, in their opinion, everything had gone in an acceptable way, and they weren't going to be pursuing any actions against their own officers in this case?
We were invited to the police commission hearing. I guess I don't know how often it happens, but we were told by our lawyers. We went over there and we kind of, you know, we weren't, it was, I guess what happened was there was a closed session. We thought we were going to be able to be in the room when they kind of said their findings, but they were like, oh, well, you know, we're not going to, it's closed session, but nice to meet you, whatever, see you later. And then as we were outside, we were talking to the LA Times, like LAPD reporter. They have like a dedicated person, and we were kind of, you know, hearing mutterings, and obviously, like, we kind of, I mean, again, growing up, seeing how these things unfold, it was kind of like, we knew that that's what they were going to say. It was still like, very, you know, upsetting, but
right,
it's kind of like sort of par for the course. So yeah, that was a tough day for sure.
We've talked about on this show, I mean, it makes me feel like naive, but I sort of thought there was a chance with a police shooting that happened in this affluent, like mostly white neighborhood,
yeah,
in a Trader Joe's, at a store where so many people are just like shopping all the time, that there would be sufficient outcry. And there has been, like, I think a pretty big response, certainly within this community and from people in Trader Joe's. I mean, like, people have spoken out about this, but part of me would have thought that something would have changed in terms of protocol. But yeah, there hasn't been anything.
Yeah, and it's
at all.
It's upsetting to, you know, it's senseless to begin with, but just when those things keep happening and they hand down their decision, it's, and then I have to talk to people and explain to them what it means. They're like, oh, does this mean the trial is over? Then does this mean you're not going to keep suing them? I'm like, no, it's the opinion of a of a body, it doesn't have any legal ramifications for our case, you know? Mm-hmm. So I have to, and those are always hard questions to try to, you know, I don't always want to explain that to people, but people so often, things are not explained super well for the layman, you know, the regular person who doesn't have their finger on the pulse of what's going on. They don't know that they assume that the police commission findings and our trial and the trial of Atkins is all one thing. And they're very, very separate entities. So
anybody, even if you hadn't been in touch with a lawyer I think if I were in that situation, I might have thought like, oh, the commission ruled this, like we don't have any more options.
And honestly, talking to enough people, like it definitely was a little, you know, discouraging. Like, yeah, so many people thought that. I'm like, no, hell no, we're not. This is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we move forward no matter what. Like until someone tells us that we're out of the race, we're gonna take this all the way. You know. So, but again, it's that, you know, I'm there with my dad and we're changing out of our nice clothes and we're at home and it's just like, what is our life even? You know, what the hell does, like, you know. Where I went and bought a couple of newspapers the next day and there we are, you know, I was like, oh yeah, I was wearing my Hawaiian shirt. I look great in this picture, but it's like, what is even reality now? So it's a very strange thing to be in these heightened emotional states and then go home and try to be like, what do you want for dinner? Let's watch a movie. It's really hard to unwind. And then turning on the TV and Melly will pop up on the news and that I cannot get used to that.
Yeah.
It's, you know, even when we were having the event and the 1 year and all that stuff was happening and we were watching the news, it was just like as intense as when it happened.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about emotional states in the context of something that your dad said at the memorial that I was really struck by. Let me just play this clip. He began by saying that he talks to Melly.
Yeah.
He speaks, like he'll say hello to her and she talks back to him. And he asks where she is, what she's doing, and this is what he said.
She says, it's dark, it's humid. I'd rather be with my family, I'd rather be with my friends, I'd rather be with you. She says, I want to go home. There is no better place. Better place is a metaphor to fool us that there is a better place. I never met anybody who says, oh, you know what, I went to a better place. I saw Peter, I saw Paul. They say hi, no. And I know better place. Better place is here. On Earth, with your family, that's what better place is.
So that sounds to me like a response to, I'm sure, the way a lot of people have been talking to you over the last year. She's in a better place. She brought this community together because of her death and all these things. The way you and your dad talk is... It sounds to me like being comfortable in your deserved anger.
Yeah.
Not feeling guilty about being angry and sad and like having these emotions and trying to channel them into getting some kind of justice for Melly. Does that reflect how you feel?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. I think what a lot of people don't understand is like everyone can give an opinion about how they would feel and what they would do. But until you are, you know, next to your dad looking through looking through a mirror at the morgue, you know, this big plate glass window, looking at your sister who has been shot and killed, you know, 18 hours before, people don't understand. And again, I try to be, you know, understanding of people and where they're coming from and the language of loss and all this is so limited. You know, you can only say so much. There's no words. There's no combination of sentences you can say that's going to make anything better. But you hear it all the time. And sometimes it's just so overwhelming. Yeah, better place and heaven and this and it was her time and it was all these like platitudes. And it's like, no matter what, even if I, you know, believe that stuff, Melly is still gone. And I don't care what, and, you know, my dad is... you know, religious and probably believes that maybe she's in heaven, but then I hear that stuff and clearly he has doubts and clearly it's not, he doesn't find any comfort in that because Melly went to work and she didn't make it home. And what kind of planet do we live on that is an acceptable phrase?
Yeah. And sounds like people are saying when they say she's in a better place and all these things, it's kind of a version of get over it, right?
Of course. Oh, yeah. So people obviously don't say that, but they say things that are like, oh, you know, I just... you know, maybe, yeah, it's just good to move on. It's like, how do you move on? Melly was my best friend, you know, and this is the thing. People die and they all of a sudden become saints. I get it. I've been to many funerals. I understand how it works. But Melly was dope as hell and she was my best friend. And for all the times we fought and disagreed, I would have died. I would put myself in her place 1,000 times over. and it's just not an option. And that is, you know, running over the events of the day in my head, I'm always like, if one little thing right. had gone differently, whether from the beginning with Atkins and his grandmother or the police or whatever, or Melly going outside, if one little thing could have been tweaked, you know, none of this would have happened. And so, you know, I try to be understanding when people tell me that stuff, but there's just, I mean, it's full scale devastation. Yeah. There is nothing anyone will ever say to me that is going to make it okay. Even, you know, we're going to take this trial all the way. Melly's still going to be dead.
Yeah.
You know, there'll be a sense of accomplishment and that I did something right by my sister, but I'm still going to go to Forest Lawn and see her and put flowers and update her on the new Marvel movie because we love them and tell her like what happened in the new one, you know, because, or, you know, bring my Bluetooth speaker and play her a song that I think she would like, you know. It's just, it's hard, man. And again, it's like, you don't want to seem too angry, but this is, there isn't, you know, what other option does anybody have? Yeah. And anybody who would ever criticize someone in this situation for being angry or letting off some steam or whatever, you just don't get it. People yeah. don't get it. And I hope no one, I'm happy that people don't understand it, because mm-hmm. that would mean that you're part of a terrible club. I have a buddy who, his brother was murdered a few years ago, and you know, I look at him and he looks at me, and there is a level of understanding with him that I do not have with many people.
So related to that, this shouldn't be your burden to shoulder, but do you think about what you can do with the lawsuit, with speaking out about this, to try and keep other people, other families, from being in situations like this?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, we my dad and I talk about, you know, post-trial when we win it and what we're going to do. And the problem is, you know, the grief process is interrupted by the legal process. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like at the same time we were going through the grief and the really, really hard days, there was also like, oh, well, we have to do a press conference now. And again, we decided to do it. So I'm not saying we regret it, but it's just one of those things that is, it's uncomfortable and it's awful, but we decided.
Not something you're going to get used to.
Yeah. And, but we decided to right. go down this road and sometimes it's really tough and awful but it's just kind of like what we have to do. And so, you know, there's plans and things that I want to do. And, you know, everybody says, oh, you should write a book, you should do this. And I mean, I want to do all those things. But right now I need there to be a definitive end to this yeah. as far as the trial and justice for Melly. Once we have that, then I can start thinking about, and then that should, I'm sorry, can I curse
Please.
On this? You know, then I can like live a somewhat normal life and try to do something good in the name of Melly. And that's all I ever try to do, you know? And that's the thing, is my mind is always like, what am I going to do for Melly? You know what? I got a bowling, bought my own bowling ball. I put her name on it. I, you know, we made these bracelets just to make them, you know, we made t-shirts before we even thought of having an event, you know, it's always going to be what. And so, yeah, I have a lot of nothing that I really want to, cause you know, I might say something and I'm like, oh, it never happened. It never came to fruition. But yeah, I want Melly to be remembered as, you know, again, her last action on this earth was to go help someone. Not, you know, for a second thinking, what if she didn't, you know, everything happened so quickly. There was no way anybody could have known what was on the other side of that door. And so for me, it's like, I want to live my life that way. Helping people, doing things, no matter, you know, what might be waiting on the other side. Because we don't know. It could have just been a car accident. Could have called 911. It'd be completely different. But it wasn't. And so for me, it's like, I gotta live with that. And I want her spirit to live on. And you know, what better way than to just evangelize her basically to anyone that I come across, you know?
You post about Melly on Twitter.
All the time.
At that digital urn.
Yeah, yeah.
People can find you there and get more updates about what you and your dad are doing in her memory and to get justice for her. Albert, thank you so much.
Thanks you guys. For coming on. Appreciate the show. It.
Thanks everyone for listening to LA Podcast. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.